Okay, good afternoon. So today we're going to continue by finishing up talking about return-oriented programming, and depending on how much time we have left, I'll talk a little bit about doing the mitigation you always want to do, which is bounds checking, and how efficiently that can be implemented. First, some logistical notes. So next class on Monday is a review for our exam on Wednesday. I'd appreciate it if you come with questions. If you don't come with questions, it'll be a very short class. There's also the format string assignment and so something is happening. Yes, sorry. The exam, the midterm will cover stuff since this last exam. We probably still expect you to read assembly, but other than that, I will not be talking about metamorphic viruses or anything like that. Also, I'd like to talk a little bit about the final exam, which is the last exam. So the prior format that Davidson's used, which I will partly borrow, is that the final was half a challenge assignment, which is take home, do before, and half a written part. This is the format I want to follow. I'll be probably a little bit different than what Davidson's done in the past. So my plan is to have a challenge assignment of about like 5 or 6 exercises, of which you have to do like any 3 or 4. And probably something like 3 of them will be very, very similar to a homework, and 3 of them will be things we only discussed in lecture. Something like that. I haven't made it yet, so I don't know how many good challenges I have, but that's my sort of plan. In the past, Davidson's done something where he like gave some bonus to people who finished it early. I don't think that's a good idea, because I know you're doing other things at the beginning of May. But the intention is that this would be released like at the end of April and due before the final, and like May 10th. And I think it makes sense, because most of what we want you to learn are things where it's better to actually be like manipulating code and such. So that's the anticipated format of the final, is half that and half a written part, which will be cumulative. And about the length of a normal midterm, because it's only half of the final. And about the time for a normal midterm. Okay. So any questions on logistics? Yes.
So the final is not going to be 3 hours?
Yeah, so with this plan, the final will not be 3 hours in class. We'll have the final room for that amount of time, but I certainly hope to make something shorter. Yeah.
Is the take-home final open?
Yeah, so it will be of the same, similar format to our assignments. So, you can't work with each other, but at least you can't share code or like specific things like that. But as far as like you can use internet resources and such, things like that, talk to PAs. Yeah.
Should we use previously written code?
Yes, and you can absolutely like reuse code that you used for a prior assignment. Which would be helpful, like if we give you another Stack Overflow with a slightly different program, that should be easy. Yeah? Yeah, so there's going to be a written part, because some of the things we're covering, I can't really think of a way of putting in like a sort of programming assignment like the overflow assignment. I can't like put it in that format and make it sane for you. So there will be a written part which is more conceptual.
And that will be not take-home.
That will be not take-home, yeah. Yeah. That will be cumulative and around 75 minutes. Yeah.
So we're expected to finish within 75 minutes, not 3 hours?
The written part within 75 minutes, yeah. I'll adjust the length based on what we actually write. So I haven't actually written the challenge problems. I have the ones from last semester, but they're all 32-bit and built without optimization. So I don't want to do that. And I haven't written the final, but I'll base it how long I think it should take you. Like, my goal in making the length of midterms is that it should be reasonable for almost everyone to finish in the allotted time. Like, there shouldn't be time pressure, and I think there wasn't last time. I know people stayed the whole time, but I don't think it was because people didn't feel like they could possibly finish the problems in that time. It was more that they were checking over answers and things like that. Is that agree with people's assessments? Yes, no, kind of. Okay, yeah. Okay, so with logistics out of the way, let's go to talking about ROP again. So we had our example of return-oriented programming, which is how we're executing code without being able to write executable data at all. And our solution was we'd reuse these gadgets from the original program, and they formed kind of their own programming language. You can think of it literally as a programming language, as an instruction set that we can use. And in pretty much any program, we can find enough of interesting gadgets like pop, ret, and move, call, these little snippets of code that we can jump to and chain together by having them jump from one to the other to do whatever we like. And in fact, there's research papers that have shown that, you know, they take a typical application, you look for gadgets in it, and you can prove you can make a Turing machine if you know what a Turing machine is. Which means you can literally like write loops in this. I'm not talking about how we're doing you do that, but it's possible to do that. You know, and we just need some initial place, just like we had before. We had some function pointer, like a return address we overwrote, and got to the gadgets. And you know, combined with getting some information like to find a pointer, this gets rid of the two big mitigations we have that are actually deployed, which is ASLR, you know, address space layout randomization. We defeat just by having a pointer to somewhere so we can know how to set the pointers to the gadgets. So we get a pointer, and since the whole modules are loaded all together, we just need a pointer to anything in a particular module of the program, like a library or an executable, and we know everything. And it defeats writex or execute because we're not writing any new machine code. We're just writing things that use machine code. And it doesn't care about stack canaries if you overwrite a non-return address pointer. Stack canaries are a little annoying for this because they make it so there's less returns for you to find, but they're still probably enough. And when I finished up last time, I was mentioning that we don't need Stack Overflow to do this. So in the examples we've given, you start with a return, and you're in the middle of the stuff you've written. And the most natural thing is you find these gadgets which push or pop something from the stack, like often happens at the end of functions. And then do some control transfer, usually by returning. And this meant that it seems like that this technique is not going to be effective unless you can actually manipulate what's on the stack. And we mentioned last time that, well, you can actually set this up without returns. There are gadgets which don't use returns, and you can use this to set the stack pointer and then use the much bigger library of gadgets that use returns. And I noticed when revising my slides that I had an error in my example, because this call instruction pushes something on the stack, so you can't pop. If you pop into the stack pointer, you'll pop the address of the gadget. But here's an example of how I could take an overflow into some other function pointer that's not a return address, where I don't control what's on the stack, and use it to control the stack. So I have this first gadget here, which pops something into RDX, and then calls something using RDI as a pointer to an address. So a pointer to a function. It's not a function pointer itself, it's a pointer to a function pointer. And then something which pops into RSP, what would be the value at RDX, and then returns. And these are two gadgets, one from each line. And we can use this with a general overwrite by, say, overwriting some vtable entry so to arrange it to point to this first gadget. And then we can set RDX and RDI just by controlling what the arguments are to that function pointer that's called. So RDI is going to be the first argument. RDX is going to be the third argument. So if the attacker can figure out what those arguments are and specify them, they can actually use this to set up the stack pointer to a value of their choice and do the rest of the stuff with the technique where we had just everything on the stack and we chose what was popped and so on. So to give an example of how this might happen in a real program, and let's take an example of what some vulnerable, say, C++ code might look like. So here we have an object foo, which contains virtual functions. It contains functions which depend on whether we have a foo or a subclass of foo. And then we have some method we can call that uses a vtable lookup. So we have our copy of foo here, and it has a vtable pointer, which points to a table which has a pointer to the actual implementation of the method for this type of foo object. So this call here actually uses that. And we also have this convenient buffer that we can overflow in the middle of our bar object, something that might happen if you're writing sloppy C. And when we overflow that buffer, because of how typically C++ objects are laid out, we get to overflow into overwrite the foo pointer and the values of x and y. Just because they're part of the object and we overflowed a buffer that's in the object. And we can set that foo pointer to point wherever we like. And a good choice would be to point back to the buffer. So now, this code here, which is trying to call some method on a foo, thinks, oh, my foo starts right where that buffer is. And I'm going to look for a vtable pointer in that foo. So we just need to have a vtable pointer here that doesn't point to a real vtable, but points to something where it's going to find some method. So we have this vtable pointer here, and as part of setting up this attack, in addition to choosing the value of foo to point here and choosing x and y appropriately, we set up that vtable pointer such that with the same offset, there's a pointer to that gadget we want to run. And in the process of this, we know based on how this call to foo happens, so we're calling foo some method with x and y, what that translates to in a typical C++ implementation is we do a vtable lookup of the appropriate vtable entry, and we pass a pointer to foo, and then the other arguments as the later arguments. So RDI is going to be a pointer to the buffer, because that's the first argument, is our foo, which we overwrote, and x and y are where our other arguments come from, RSI and RDX. Questions on this setup? Yeah. Which, this here, or?
The one at the bottom, marked by comments.
This is the implementation of the buff. So we call foo arrow some method is what you write in C++ to call some method on foo. The actual implementation of that is something that you could write in C this way, where we take foo, we access a member of it called vtable, which is a pointer to an array of function pointers. We access some entry of that array and use that as a function pointer, and we pass foo to that function. This is the typical implementation of this method call when we need to worry about foo having subclasses. Any questions? That makes sense? So,
when you say we, it doesn't mean we as in the hacker or we as in just general programmers?
So this is how the C++ compiler implements functions. So what the attacker is doing is just replacing foo with pointing to the thing the compiler set up to something they set up. And they're just setting up the same structures, just in a different place. So they have a V table here, and a pointer to the V table. It just is in the buffer they wrote instead of elsewhere in memory, like the compiler would put it. Yeah?
Wouldn't this be blocked by XOR execute for if you were to have a buffer large enough?
So the question is, wouldn't this be blocked by write XOR execute? So where is the code we're executing? So far, we haven't called the gadget yet. Everything we've done is entirely in bar. And it's until we use this gadget pointer, everything is entirely in bar and code that already exists in the application. And once we, and as long as we make this pointer here, that's our some method, what we're telling the program is the attacker is telling the program is some method instead of what the compiler did. As long as we make that point to an existing gadget, we still aren't executing code that we've written, machine code that we've written. This is something that already exists elsewhere in the program we're pointing to. So it still defeats write XOR execute. We still haven't run our own machine code. Yeah?
So the sum method is part of the gadget pointer?
So what do you mean? So the gadget pointer replaces where the compiler expects to look for sum method. So when we do this call, it's saying, I need to look up where sum method is. So does this lookup in this table here is what it wants to do to find where sum method is for this kind of foo, because foo might have like a, you know, different subclasses, and it needs to know which one to use. So it's doing that lookup using our pointer, the attacker's pointer, I should say, instead of the real pointer the compiler set up. And it's looking where it's going to find some method in this table, which the attacker set up. So we didn't replace, so we replaced some method by replacing the pointer it looks for to where to find some method. Other questions? Yeah.
How do the X and Y ends get placed into RSI and RDS?
How do they get? So the question is, how does X and Y get placed into RDI and RDX? So our call in bar, the normal code that's supposed to run is supposed to load X and Y from bar and pass them to foo's method. So that's the code which is going to load them from this part of the object. So that's how that's happening. So as long as that load happens after the get s, it's going to work out that way. So people still look confused, understandably, since I don't think I went over how vtables work quite enough, and it is a confusing concept. And one we strangely don't cover, even though we cover C++. Yeah?
So is this going to be like a general way to do this thing, or does it need like a special setup?
So the question is this a general way to do this thing? So it depends what you call general. So obviously some things here are specific to this setup, but generally, you know, anytime you have a pointer that's used to find a function, you can do something like this. And that's the only real precondition we needed. Now, we need to like look carefully at the code around using this function pointer in order to know how to get things set up correctly for this gadget. Like, we actually needed to know what RDIX and RDI would be, which is not something that you can do with just any function call. So it's not as nice as it was when we pointed to our own machine code, where we don't care what any of the registers are. We're just going to write them with their own values. But that doesn't make it substantially more difficult, because usually some register will be set to some value that's the attacker controls. Right? It only makes sense. Like, you have a buffer where we're reading input that the attacker controls. Probably some value related to that buffer is in some register. So we can usually do this sort of thing. The exact setup will vary, because sometimes we'll have this sort of indirection to our pointer, sometimes we won't, and other variation like that. So, yeah. But this is the sort of thing that you probably need to do with modern exploits, to set up this sort of little chain of things is quite frequently, because in addition to defeat the mitigations, and because this is a more common sort of exploit in modern, or vulnerability in modern programs than Stack Overflows because of things like Stack Canaries. So other questions? Yeah. So the question is, why are X and Y above the buffer? So part of the reason is because I wanted to make this example simple. And make it easy to do that. I don't think it would actually help that much if they weren't, because maybe you can find a gadget which only uses RDI. So now, like reads a pointer from RDI and pushes RDI or something like that. That might exist. So it's not like a guarantee. So there's a rule in C and C++ which says that usually you have to actually place these objects, the member variables. Is that the term you used in 2150, by the way? Did you use member variables or some other term? Who used member variables? What?
Fields.
Fields, okay, so you called them fields. The C++ standard calls them member variables. Go figure. Java calls them fields, so you use fields. So the fields of a C struct or a C++ object generally have to be placed in the order they're declared in memory. There's just a rule in the standards which say that. But it couldn't have to be that way. It would make sense to try to reorder them to make this less likely. But I think you'd still be in trouble in that case because probably you can find alternatives to this. And other registers are going to be set to use full values, like probably after getS is called, where does its return out value go? RAX. And it happens that getS returns its buffer. Returns the buffer it's passed in. And probably RAX won't have been reset in the machine code, in the assembly that implements this function. So like that would be another register you control. It's less obvious than the argument ones, but there's still other registers that you can control just because the code around the call happens to set them and not reset them. Because when you call a function in your assembly, you don't reset every single register first. And that would make your program much slower if you did. And so with this gadget, we can, it jumps to what RDI points to. RDI is the first argument, so that happens to be where the vtable pointer, the quote-unquote vtable pointer points. So we just put that entry here, and we set RDX, and this is the first part of that setting the stack pointer sequence I showed you earlier. And this is apparently the sort of thing you might do when you're exploiting a real vulnerability when you have to deal with WriteX or execute. And you don't have a Stack Overflow. But it's doable and people do it reliably. So more questions on this? Okay. So there's a sort of variant of return-oriented programming based on this sort of thing called jump-oriented programming. So in return-oriented programming, most of the time, we have this gadget that ended with a return. That's the most obvious way to do this because that pops something from a list and goes there. That's sort of the natural setup for this sort of mini programming language of snippets of machine code in the original program. But it turns out that we can just work with gadgets that end with a call or a jump. And just by relying by things like we saw earlier, just happening to know that this little snippet of code sets the registers in the right way based on pointers that they see. And setting up the appropriate things for them to point to make this happen. And you can potentially never set the stack pointer and still do useful stuff. And people have shown, the same way that return-oriented programming lets you do a whole lot,
that this generally is actually as powerful. It's just harder to find the gadgets. Less obvious how to use them, but usually if you look enough, it seems like they can do everything still, even if you never return. And this problem means that a lot of ideas you might have for making return-oriented programming not practical probably don't work. Like, an obvious solution that people in the research were trying to do was, why don't we just generate programs which don't have any useful gadgets? So the natural way of doing that is to take every single return, including instances of the opcode C3 and other instructions, and make sure it's not a useful gadget. For example, there's either you change the other instructions to use a different constant that doesn't contain C3, or for the returns, you just like have a stack canary check right before it, so you can't use it as a gadget. So that might be an idea you'd have, and that people have had in the literature for making return-oriented programming not possible. But because you don't actually need returns, that doesn't work. In addition to being rather tricky to do. It seems tricky to make your compiler never generate instructions which contain a return inside them. Because like the call offset happens to contain the byte C3. But maybe you could do it. So with both these techniques, I mentioned that we have tools for finding these gadgets, which is what any sane person uses. Either they write a tool and use it, or find a tool and use it. These days, you can probably find a tool and use it. And the way the tools work is they just take an executable file, they find out which parts of it will be loaded as executable and not just writable, and they look for opcodes for every single kind of arbitrary jump. So they look for the opcodes for return, for jump to a register with a pointer or not, call to a register with a pointer or not. And they just go 1 byte before, 2 bytes before, 3 bytes before, 4 bytes before, and so on, and start disassembling and see what they get. And they just get a list of this, sort it, and give it to you, and this is your programming language. And so if you're doing this by hand, you get that big list of possible instructions and you just search through it to look for a way to do something. And if you want to automate this, you can take a bit of an assumption and just say, let's assume that certain kinds of gadgets exist in any program, like a gadget to pop from the stack into any argument register. That may or may not exist, but it's a good guess that probably that's there. And you can just say, I want to look for exactly that. Or to write to a memory location that's specified in another register. So move from some register to parentheses some other register. You can say, probably that exists somewhere in the program next to a return. And maybe to clear a register. And there are automated tools which basically work by saying, I'm going to assume that these gadgets exist, and based on that, I'm going to look for one of them, and I have a fixed way of chaining them together, depending on which ones of those are available, which registers they use, etc., and I'm just going to chain them together. And that's what the tool you're going to use for a future homework does. It just has templates for gadgets it wants to find. It wants to find a pop some register ret. Wants to find a move some register, parentheses some other register. It looks for that, and then it has a fixed template where it can figure out what registers are available with the gadgets that exist, and it chains them together and makes it work. And combined with a gadget that lets you do an OS call, this is definitely sufficient to do, any fixed set of stuff. No computation necessarily. Computation requires a little extra, but this lets you pretty much call anything, any system call, which is probably all you need to do. And just like with stack smashing, so in the overflow assignment, one of the options, which pretty much no one used when I glanced over on time submissions, was to just use some pre-written shellcode that runs a shell. Right, runs a command line so you can enter commands. That's a common thing people do with stack smashing.
And you can do the same sort of thing with return-oriented programming. You can say, here's a library that everyone uses. Let me just have a sequence of gadgets I know opens a command line given that library. So I don't know how many of these have happened. I know that the second example, so for example, a lot of people were trading around a list of gadgets for the Windows C library. There was a standard list that worked that would copy some data to executable memory. And then they just run stuff as they did without writer X or execute. So someone just once, for every single Windows program that used the C library on Windows, wrote this sequence of gadgets, and then you could use it in any exploit to do anything, because it sets up you to do everything else without worrying about programming with gadgets. And this is commonly what people do with return-oriented programming, is they just do enough work so that they can write their program more conveniently. They could do whatever they want with return-oriented programming, but they just do the minimum stuff to either like run a command or to run some machine code that they wrote in spite of write X or execute. So that's all I have on ROP. So ROP is just that, you know, this idea that there's various ways of chaining together existing snippets of code. And the surprising empirical discovery is that these existing snippets of code are powerful enough to do whatever the attacker would have been doing by writing their own machine code and jumping to it in almost all cases. Like conceptually, you could imagine making a program where there aren't existing sequences of code like this, but people have not come across it when the programs are of non-trivial size, or like have a library of non-trivial size. And you can think of this as being sort of its own machine language, that each library forms its own machine language, and usually that machine language, it has like really weird instructions that you never implement in a processor, but it's enough. So any questions on return-oriented programming or jump-oriented programming before I talk about our next topic? Okay, so the things we've looked at so far are very much band-aid solutions. They're basically detect something, consequence of memory corruption, and hope you can do something about it, like make it not work. So write X or execute is about, yeah, we assume our attackers are going to cause us to try to run random code. We're just going to make sure that it's not code they wrote. ASLR is we assume our attackers are going to overwrite pointers to point to stuff they want to point to. We're just going to make it so they can't figure out how to point to stuff they want to point to. But we're still going to let them do the overwriting. And stack canaries are, we know that attackers are going to overwrite things on the stack. We just don't want them to be able to figure out what exactly to overwrite to make it work. But we're still going to let the stack overwrite happen. And we're just going to make sure the consequences aren't as bad. All these solutions are sort of about something bad's going to happen. I'm going to prevent it from being really bad. Usually by turning it into a seg fault after the fact. So after the attacker's done something that would previously, get us in trouble, we're going to make it so that usually the attacker wouldn't have been able to do it quite right, so it won't seg fault. But if they do it exactly right, it still works, as we've seen. And this isn't the first solution everyone has when we look at buffer overflows. The first solution everyone has when you see a buffer overflow is, why don't we just check the array bounds? Why don't we just do that? And you all know that it's definitely possible to do this because you regularly use programming languages which check array bounds. Like Java and Python, you can't access an array, as far as you know, without checking its bounds, probably. So why don't we just add bounds checking to C and get rid of this problem? Yeah?
Can you
It takes a lot. So, yeah, so the big question is going to be overhead. So the big, you know, how much extra time is it going to take? There's some other trickiness about doing it, which we'll get to later, which is that you have to figure out how you change the calling convention if you're checking array bounds. But let's start with the simple cases. So there's some embarrassingly simple cases where it would be easy to add bounds checking. So one example is when you're using a function like memcopy. So memcopy takes a destination buffer, a source buffer, and a length. And it copies from the source to the destination length number of bytes. And this is a very important function for performance, so it's often like special case in the compiler, even. And you know, it seems like for something like this, it would be really simple to just check len. It would also be pretty fast, because you know, we're already copying 42 bytes. Are you going to really notice a single comparison for a 42-byte copy? And on modern Linux, for example, it actually does this. Now, this is a bit weird, because if you think about the straightforward way of translating this into assembly, there wouldn't be any length check, right? The straightforward way is you copy buffer to RSI, attacker control to RDI, and so on. Buffer, and length to RDX. There's no checking whatsoever. Memcopy doesn't have the information to know the length of buffer, for example. And this is usually the big problem with adding bounds checking to C. It's that with something like this, ordinarily, memcopy has no way of knowing how big buffer is. It's not passed when we translate this to assembly. So we're going to, if you want to make this work more generally, not just for something that's special case like memcopy is, we're going to need to do more work. But memcopy, it turns out, is special cased. So if you compile this on Linux and look at the assembly, this is what it looks like. That we allocate space for buffer, we load a pointer to it into RDI, then we move the length into somewhere, we move length into the right argument, assign to argument, and we pass this extra 42 argument. The compiler passes this extra argument, which is the length of the buffer for us. And it doesn't call memcopy, but it calls this weird function called memcopychk. So memcopy is declared in a special way that lets GCC generate this code instead of the more straightforward code, which would never have the 42 be passed to the function being called. Yeah?
Can you not still do the overflow attack that we were doing before, where you just write so much that it overflows the...
So the question is, can we not do... What do we want to overflow? So...
Is the length coming from...
The length is coming from, in this case, a global variable, let's say, or the stack. But it doesn't matter. If the length is wrong, we're passing 42 into ECX separately. So memcopy check, when it implements this, it's going to take the minimum of 42 in len. Actually, it's going to compare 42 in len, and if 42 is less than the length, it's going to abort. Yes, so the len variable in this case is controlled by our attacker. And that's fine, because memcopy check is going to use this 42 and say, and if 42 is smaller than the length, it's going to abort our program and say, someone tried to overflow something.
So that's what I was wondering. Like before we were saying, like, if you just write a lot, if you input a lot, then like length will overflow.
Yeah, so yeah, but it doesn't matter what length is the issue. So the attacker can set length to infinity, and it won't matter. And so you're wondering about integer overflow? Is that what you're wondering about? So memcopy check is going to be written to do the comparison correctly. So it's going to look at this 42, and it's going to never overflow inside it. That is another part of writing memcopy,
is making sure you actually do this comparison right, with even in the cases when lambda is like negative, or seems to be negative. So it needs to handle that, but it will. Okay. So this sort of special casing of commonly used functions like memcopy is a thing that was added to C on Linux and some other platforms, and the common name for it is fortify source, named after the option that controls it. This is actually a pound define, and the header files you include, when you pound include string.h, there's some ifdef fortify source, which defines a special version of memcopy that does this by using GCC only features that aren't part of the C language that say, if you know the length of this buffer, then call this other version of the function. And that's special case for a whole bunch of standard string and array functions in the standard library. And there's different options to specify how much of this feature is enabled or to disable it. And this is one of the things I need to do to prepare your homework, since I need to turn off fortify source. So this adds bounds checkings to length and array, string and array functions. And it also even adds protection to printf. It adds it uses a version of printf which disables %n unless the format string is in read-only memory. That's only on this two option because that's not backwards compatible. Like it conceptually could maybe break a program. But it seems like a good idea, because who uses %n besides attackers? And who is using %n would use it in a format string that they write at runtime. So this is a simple thing that C compilers can do to make it easier to write safe C code, to catch some errors automatically, and do it in a way which doesn't require any changes to programs. So you can also do work as a programmer and as a library writer to make it easier to do this. So it's kind of a problem. You know, I think it's kind of not nice that this memcopy function here, you know, takes the length of stuff to copy, which is naturally going to be the size of our source, and doesn't actually give us a convenient way to say, by the way, my destination is this big, and you should fail if it's not. So the compiler implemented this feature only because it knew the size of buffer. But wouldn't it be really nice to have a version of memcopy that lets us specify that? And isn't that something we want to do any time we're passing around a thing to write to, is specify the length of the thing to write to? So the C library sometimes does this sort of thing. So for example, these are a bunch of non-bounds checking C library functions, which are also very hard to protect with fortify source, though I think it tries. So string copy copies a null terminated string from one buffer to another. It takes no length. There's no bounds check implied in the function. But there's another version of it, string ncopy in the library, which takes a size. Same with string cat. String cat takes a null terminated string and appends another null terminated string on it. It assumes there's enough space after the string in memory to do that. If there's not, it overflows the buffer. But there's another version of it which does take the size of the destination. And sprintf printfs, but not to output, to a string that you specify as the first argument, but it doesn't take a size. You're supposed to just write your format string really carefully. But there's another version of it which does take a size. And C has this unfortunate legacy that all these functions at top were added to the library first. And then people got used to them. And then people realized, no, maybe that wasn't such a good idea, and added these other versions. And there's been some effort to add more versions of existing functions. For example, Microsoft has an extension to memcopy, which takes a destination size argument to make that easier to do. And this is something you should think about when you're writing libraries for C, languages like that, where you need to do the checking, is making sure you ask for the sizes. So you can check that. Yeah. So the question is why for memcopy wouldn't you do that? It's error prone to do that because usually you're going to take the size of the source, right? Because that's the amount of stuff you want to copy. Usually you think, I have a buffer which is big enough for any input. It's usually the philosophy around using memcopy. So the idea of writing a version which takes the destination size is that you would need to take the minimum anyways. Why don't we do that for you and make it so you're less likely to forget to do that comparison? Because the bug with this code here is that I forgot to check len. And I always need to do it. Why shouldn't the library do it for me? Yeah?
If you're doing this like on-the-fly buffer, like with the new tag or something, would it calculate the memcopy on-the-fly too? Or would it just call the old
buffer? So the question is, if buffer is like char star buffer equals new something,
yeah, and then you get that.
What will it do? So what it's going to do in that case is that it's not going to pass useful number here. So this additional protection that the compiler does only helps in cases where the compiler can figure out how to write this move 42. If it can't figure it out, it's just going to default to doing something unsafe, which is unfortunate. So this is not a complete solution. It doesn't do what Java does, even. So it doesn't check the actual length. But it does handle some simple cases that we can handle with very low overhead. So here, the extra overhead we have is this extra move and an extra comparison in this memcopy function, like two extra instructions. It's like pretty much free. And that's why people have been, that's why this is usually turned on by default these days, this fortify source feature, because it pretty much never breaks the program and has essentially no performance overhead. Like probably less, much, much less than ASLR. But it means that we cannot protect in cases where the buffer size is computed. In that case, like the obvious solution of this style is that you should be passing the size. And that when you're designing APIs, you should make sure people pass sizes so they actually do the checking. But C has this unfortunate history that people started by writing functions which didn't check sizes. And it's been a long road to make it so functions do. Also, some of the functions which should check sizes are, shall we say, poorly designed. So for example, string ncopy here takes a destination, a source, and a size. If the source is larger than the destination size, then it doesn't copy the null terminator. It just copies size characters and doesn't null terminate the destination. This is almost never what you want, but someone made a mistake when designing this function. And that's what it does. So it's extra work for the programmer to use all these variants, but this is the design that if you want to write correct C, you should be using. Now, the other thing is, I should mention, C++ bounds checking. So who here has used vectors in C++? So which of these two, so who here has used the first syntax for vectors? Who has used the second syntax with .at? So some people too. OK, so you've seen both of these. So C++ provides both this syntax for vectors, where you use brackets like an array, and this .at syntax, and they're different. This first one has undefined behavior. What that usually means is that it will happily overflow a buffer that's internal to the vector. This other one is defined to throw a particular exception whenever you go out of bounds. So why do you think C++ provides both these versions? Yeah. So you think it's because one's older? Okay.
Any other guesses?
It's a lot faster
to do it without one. So, or it's a lot faster. So it's a good guess that one's older, but I think that's not actually true. I think that the existing, I could check, but I think the original library had both. Or even if one is older, they could have added bounds checking because it's undefined behavior. But the reason why they have both is mainly because people who design C++ are really, really concerned about not adding any extra overhead ever. And replacing all of these in a program, all the normal array access-like accesses to vectors with .at, usually has a really bad impact on performance. Like people report like 5x slower if a program like has a loop over a vector. It obviously varies with the compiler and all sorts of factors, but they're really concerned about performance. And that's a common reason why people don't like adding bounds checking, even in cases like this, where you definitely can add it, because this vector has the size. It's not like that call to memcopy where we wouldn't know the size from the arguments. This vector knows its size, but people still don't do the bounds checking. Just because they're worried about the speed. So let's talk about, you know, adding bounds checking to C, and how about how fast we can make it. And there have been real proposals to add bounds checking to C, including implementation. I guess we talked about, you know, the main concern is performance. So there's some cases where adding bounds checking to C is really easy. So here, I have a buffer, and I'm accessing it only in a function. If I went to add bounds checking to this, and the basic idea you have in mind is every time I use the buffer, I should check whether the index is right. So this is the basic thing transformation we want to do. And our question is going to be, how much slower does this make our programs? But this just doesn't actually work all the time. And the main reason is because we pass a pointer to a buffer, to a function, and that function uses that as an array or adds or subtracts from pointers and expects things to still work. And we want to actually do bounds checking on a pointer we passed. So we need some way of passing length information with pointers. But we could do this. So what we would do is we'd say, instead of passing pointers to functions, you're going to pass a structure which has a pointer and its bounds. So a pointer and the minimum and maximum index or point of the array it's in. And then to use this pointer, every time someone tries to use this pointer with an array like access, you check the minimum and maximum, and if they're wrong, you fail. And you just pass this structure in place of pointers everywhere. So we can use this, and we can, for example, protect string copy. And here you get to an idea of why this might be slow. But this works. So we say, OK, so I have my source pointer. Is it in range? I have my desk pointer. Is it in range? Now do the operation. Increment, check if the source pointer is still in range. Keep going. But this is a completely automatable transformation. So people have made C implementations which essentially just do this transformation. But it obviously has a huge performance impact. You know, we're doing two comparisons for every single pointer access in the straightforward implementation. And we have three times as much space for every single pointer, including space we have to pass between functions. And this is how you can get like really bad overheads for doing the straightforward thing of adding bounds checking to C. Especially since C programmers like using functions like string copy, where this seems like the most straightforward way of doing the bounds checking. Like if we wanted to short circuit this bounds checking, we can't like easily say check the maximum index outside the loop because we don't know what it is yet. We need to do a trickier transformation to get rid of some of these comparisons.
You could do that, but it's hard. And it's hard compiler work to say, for example, that, oh, I don't need to keep checking the minimum. Like, that's something you can reason about, but you can think of, how do I teach the compiler that? You could do it, but that's a lot of work. And after we've done that, it's still probably much slower than when we started. So any questions about this sort of fat pointer technique? Sort of brute force way of adding bounds checking to C? Okay, so I'm going to give an example of a slightly better technique, but it has the same sort of principle for adding bounds checking to C. And this is from a research paper called Baggy Bounds Checking by from 2009. I have some people in Cambridge, the one in the UK, not in Massachusetts. And their idea was that they wanted to do the equivalent of these checks to make sure every time you use a pointer that it's in the minimum and maximum range of the thing it points to. But they're going to do it without passing around those minimums and maximums. So if you're not passing around the minimums and maximums, where are you going to put them? What would be a good idea? I need to look up this minimum and maximum information for a pointer. Yeah. The first thing? Okay. What do you mean the first thing? In the pointer? So that's an idea. We'll get to that later probably. Yeah. So you could try to put it next to the pointer, but that we have to pass it to this function is the problem.
Well, you just pass the pointer, but you read right before it.
You read right. So the idea is you read right before the pointer. So that's problematic because we could have a pointer to the middle of a buffer. So if we only had pointers to the beginning of buffers, yes, that would be a good technique. But unfortunately, we're going to have pointers to the middle of buffers because that's how C works. But for languages which only have pointers to the beginning of buffers, which are some, that's actually a good technique. Other ideas? Okay. I'm surprised. So the one technique you can think of is a hash table. You could just have a hash table mapping from pointer to location. And this is essentially the baggy bounds checking idea. They have a giant lookup table, which is an array with one entry for every 16 bytes of memory. That seems a little big. We'll get to how we keep that manageable. And this array tells us where objects start. And what we're going to do is every time we try to manipulate a pointer, when we like take an array and add something to it, we make sure it starts in the start of that object is the same place, that we haven't switched from one thing, one array, to something else. So this is the form of the check we're going to add, and it's a little bit better than the minimum maximum check we had before, but not much. But it's basically the same idea. We're making sure that our pointer still points in the same object, and we have a way of taking any arbitrary pointer value and looking up what object is that in. What thing on the stack or malloc is that in? So the problem with this, of course, is that this start of table, which has one entry for every 16 bytes of memory, seems positively huge. So we're going to have some tricks to manage this. And the cute trick that this paper does is that they add some restrictions to objects. That the table of pointers to starting locations is not going to be huge because we're going to only have certain kinds of objects, so we're going to have a very compact representation. So our restrictions are all objects are going to be sized in powers of 2. If you want to allocate a 100-byte buffer, it's going to be 128 bytes. If you want to allocate a 200-byte C++ object, it's going to be 256 bytes. You just make all objects a power of 2 size. And all objects are going to start in an address which is a multiple of their size. So this means that the information we need to store in the table actually is only the size of the object. We know where that object starts because we know it's the nearest lower multiple of the size, and we know the size by just knowing the power of 2 index. And it turns out then that our table entries are going to be 1 byte. So we have 1/16th overhead instead of like 1/2 overhead for space. And you know, you can do some pointer manipulation to actually compute this, like bitwise operations, which maybe you'll remember from 3830, maybe not. But it's important that we can do this with bitwise operations because this means that we can write fast assembly code to do this computation. And so with that restriction, our memory layout looks kind of strange. So, you know, so we have our objects, which I've represented as blue, which are allocated in power of two slots. So the objects don't take up all of the slots, but we're going to declare that the entire slot is a legal place for pointers to that object to go. So if this is a buffer here, we're going to say you can overflow into the rest of the slot and we don't care. But if you go into the next slot, that's going to be a problem. And we have our table, which says for each 16 bytes, what is the size of the object containing that? And that means that for objects which take up more than 16 bytes, we have multiple table entries for the same object. So allocating objects has a bit of overhead from this, especially large objects. And because we have this multiple of size thing, we're going to have some padding. That when we wanted to allocate this big object, we might not be able to put it right here, so we have some empty space. And we also have some wasted space because we have power of two size slots. So we have padding to make the sizes of power of two. But we've done all this in order to make that table lookup manageable. So questions about how this works? This idea of our starting location lookup makes sense. So what we're going to do is we're going to check every time we have a pointer to one of these slots. We're going to check when we change that pointer to point somewhere else, does it still point to the same slot? And if it does, we're good. If it doesn't, we're going to abort the program. And we're going to check the whole slot. So if you have this buffer and we go into the red region, that's fine. If we go into this white region up here or over here, that's not fine. Yeah?
I guess this works well with the heap, because on objects when they heap, like put in kind of power of two groups or like allocation.
So the question is, does this work well with the heap because we allocate things in power of two sizes anyways? So the answer is that there's some heap allocators which do this, and some which don't. So one of the disadvantages of this technique is that it forces you to allocate in that way, and that is not faster for many programs. And in the author's evaluation, they actually found out that that was a lot of their overhead, which that they had to use a slightly worse allocator than what the program was using before, because they have to manage in power of two blocks. But for the heap, it's pretty natural to make an allocator do this. Maybe it's not the most clever allocator you could have, because you're probably wasting space, especially if the program allocates 300 byte objects all the time. But it's reasonably efficient, and you can do like bitwise fiddling tricks in allocators that use power of two sizes, which makes that an attractive design for that reason. So the heap is easy. The stack is where it gets a bit tricky. So if we allocate a buffer on the stack, then we need to set the table entries for that buffer, and we need to make that buffer be at an address which is a multiple of its size. So whereas previously we just subtracted from the stack pointer to allocate this buffer, now we need to do all this extra work. We need to make the stack pointer be a multiple of 128, because that's the size the buffer is going to end up having. We need to actually allocate the 128 bytes, and we need to move things into the table to say this is actually 128 bytes thing here. And this is where a lot of that overhead comes from. So in addition to the checks, we have the main overhead of maintaining our lookup table. So where we got rid of the overhead of passing these fat pointers everywhere, we have this extra overhead when we allocate objects. That seems better because at least we're managing less value, so it should be less overhead, but it's still pretty expensive looking.
Yeah.
at least looks pretty expensive. So all this sort of extra manipulation makes sense. Okay. So the other thing you might worry about is this table here. So there's one entry, was one byte for every 16 bytes of memory. So that seems pretty big. That's 1/16 overhead, and it's for every address. So how do we actually make sure that table doesn't like take up all of our memory, especially on 64-bit? You know, if you allocate an array which can contain our stack pointer at address 1 trillion and our code at address like 400,000, that would use up all the memory on your system. Yeah?
You do it like a page table where it only actually uses the data if it has something there.
Yeah, so the question is, couldn't we just use a page table where there's only data if there's something there? And that's precisely what we'll do. So the lookup table, it's going to be a region of memory, but we're only going to allocate the parts where which correspond to stuff we actually have allocated. The other parts will allow to segfault. And that's fine, because if you try to look up a pointer to here, that means your pointer is invalid and your program should crash. You went out of bounds. So this is their trick for making that table not be completely huge, but it is still 1/16 the size of our memory that we actually are using. And we actually need to add lookup code. So when we're doing this sort of character operation, we need to look up the table entry and do the pointer comparison at the bottom. This is a figure from the paper about the code they added. This is the 32-bit version, obviously, since it's not using REX. But you look up the table entry. This is Intel syntax assembly, so destination on the left. Look at the table entry. Get a copy of the buffer and compare, do the XOR and shift based on this buffer entry to see if what bits changed, see if any bits greater than the size changed, in which case you went out of the slot. And if so, you're okay. If not, you do what this slow path function, which probably mostly crashes. I have the actually modified version, which I somehow didn't show you. So this is the basic idea that they had in this paper. And they could do this for unmodified C code. And you know, they had some other tricks to make this more performant. So one big thing they did is that you only need to add these checks if you know the array or pointer escapes a function. So like if you have a function which accesses an array only inside the function and never passes a pointer to it anywhere, you don't need checks for that. If you never take a pointer to an object, you don't need to set its size in the table, because you're never going to access it through a pointer. And you can otherwise also avoid adding this checking code in cases where you can somehow make the compiler realize, oh, I is never too big. And they did all these things. Okay. And this is all things you want to do. And their overhead is still going to be substantial. There was another trick they used, which is that you can avoid the table. So you said earlier that you wanted to, that maybe we could store it as part of the pointer. And this is also something they tried. So the lookup table idea works fine. But another thing you can do is you could say, I'm going to use part of the pointer to store the size of the object. Which means I'm going to divide my address, I'm going to divide memory up into the space where I allocate 32-byte objects, the space where I allocate 128-byte objects, and so on. And I'm going to mark which space I'm in with some bytes of the address. That's going to determine where that space is. So this is an alternate strategy they tried. It wasn't their primary one, because at the time, in 2009, 32-bit was still important. And on 32-bit, this is a lot less attractive. Because when you subtract the extra, if 5 plus this is 32 bits, you've lost a lot of space. But in 64-bit, it's actually pretty reasonable. They have 38 bits left over. after things that the OS uses, which is what the zero OS and the processor uses, is what the zeros are for, and they still have 5 bits of size information, which lets them support up to 2 gigabyte objects. Now it's a little trickier to extract the size from the pointer, but it's about as bad as the table lookup. And this avoids even having the table, so you avoid the memory overhead, but it makes memory allocation less flexible, because you have to have sort of separate memory regions for each size, which means that you have probably more wasted space. Not necessarily, but probably. So after all these tricks, after having the compiler do the optimization and making this table or these end things in the pointer, which they call tags, which tell you the size of objects, only contain the power of 2, and all those tricks, these were their experimental results. So they tried a bunch of benchmarks that were popular, and depending on the benchmark you use, their overhead in time was 4 to 70%. So for some programs, pretty nice. For some programs, maybe not so nice. Probably depending on how many like array accesses were in the program. And about 10 to 20% space overhead. And tag pointers were slightly better in both categories, but not that much. Not that much for space overhead because you needed to allocate extra space to have the different memory regions for different tags. But this is what you can do. So it shows that, yeah, it's possible to add bounce checking to C. It also shows you why people don't do it. So this was a solution where they tried really, really hard to make it as fast as possible. And it wasn't that fast. And that's why it's hard to convince people to just use bounce checking in C. Because they're not going to like you saying, well, if your program does a lot of array accesses everywhere and functions you call, it might be 50% slower. Maybe they should, because security problems are really bad, but that's not an argument, I think, which actually works in the real world. So any questions on this whole idea of this sort of research example? So something I'd like to note, another thing which makes these bounce checkings harder than you think they would be, is that real C programs do things that you shouldn't do. For example, this is a common pattern in real C programs. I never want to see you doing it, but you will find commercial software or open source, widely used software, like academic software, which does this. Deliberately makes a pointer outside of an array with the intention of using it to access the array. So here we have a pointer to before the array, and we're going to access array 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 to access the array. And it's important enough that if you want to implement bounce checking in C, you need to make this work. And they did this, and that's actually some extra work they did. Is that they have that's part of their slow path, is that they handle this when it goes outside of a slot. So they make the slot big enough so it's in the middle, but they handle the case where it goes outside of a slot and make sure that they can actually recover benign out of bounds like this. Yeah. So the question is this defined behavior? No, it isn't. But there's so defined behavior, if you don't know or remember, is what the C standard says is supposed to work. And the C standard says that when you take this pointer, that is an error, and you are not allowed to do that. The C standard does let you take a pointer one past the end of an array, that's actually a special case, but before is technically not allowed. But if you're implementing a solution where you want to say at the top of your paper that it's backwards compatible, and you want to tell people who you're marketing your solution to that it's backwards compatible, you can't do what the C standard says. You need to do what works with real C programs. That's an unfortunate fact of life for people who are making security mitigations. No, that just because the standard lets you do it doesn't mean you can.
I guess I'm out of time. So I'll note that this was our bounds checking solution, and we didn't fix some things that you want to fix. So there's more to be done. And that's what I have. So Monday is exam review. So come with questions, please. And remember that there's a homework due Friday, all that.
Saturday, right?
Saturday, yes. Like it says on the webpage.